prey in muddy river bottoms. These beautiful and unique creatures face an ever-increasing threat of extinction due to habitat loss, hunting by humans, underwater noise pollution, river damming, and lethal encounters with boats or fishing nets. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Vincent Yannick and Hugh Rendell at St. Andrews University. I'm Don Glass.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
In sports, the first-place St. Louis Cardinals open a four-game series in San Diego tonight with right-hander Joel Piñeiro getting the start. He's 5-0 over his last eight starts. The Chicago Cubs send left-hander Tom Gorelzany to the mound tonight in the first of four games against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Jeff Weaver starts for the Dodgers, who still have the best record in the National League at 71-50. It's a night off for the Chicago White Sox, who trail Detroit by two games in the American League Central race. The Sox host Baltimore over the weekend. And Chicago Blackhawks star Patrick Kane was to be arraigned this afternoon on misdemeanor charges that he battered a cab driver during a dispute over a fare in Buffalo, New York. Kane was indicted yesterday. The grand jury dropped a more serious felony charge. That's a look at sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Busey Bank Main Branch renovation, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:43. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. My guest in this portion of the program is award-winning writer Denise Giardina. She joins me this afternoon to talk about her new novel, Emily's Ghost. The Emily of the title is Emily Bronte, author of Wuthering Heights. Emily comes through in this novel as a strong and independent woman walking alone at night on the moors near her family's home in a small, poor, isolated village in northern England. The story is also one of the Bronte family and of a young idealistic clergyman by the name of William Waitman. Denise Giardina, an ordained deacon in the Episcopal Church who lives in Charleston, West Virginia, is now the author of five novels. Emily's Ghost, a novel of the Bronte sisters, is published by Norton. Denise, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to talk to you.
What was your introduction to the writings of the Brontes?
Well, you know, it goes so far back, it's pretty amazing. Actually, I couldn't even read when I was first introduced to the Brontes. My mother belonged to a book club and got an edition of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights in this wonderfully illustrated version with the woodcuts by Fritz Eichenberg, who was an artist back in the 1930s. And I used to look at the illustrations when I was a little kid, but, you know, when I was 4 and 5 years old, and I used to look at these pictures such as Heathcliff digging up Kathy's grave with this haunted expression on his face. You know, and when you're 4 or 5 years old and you look at a picture like that, it sticks with you. So I was aware of those books even before I could read them, and then, of course, as I grew older, I was able to read them and have just been fascinated by the Brontes ever since.
Yeah. When you were seeing those illustrations, were you making up your own story?
I was making up my own stories. I really don't remember what they were. But each illustration was somewhat different, and I would try to think of something to go along with it. So
yeah.
it was part of my early writing process, I think.
Yeah. Why did you choose to focus this book on Emily?
Well, two reasons. One is that I just personally found her much more interesting, but second, also, I just became aware over the years as I've read a number of Bronte biographies, including the early one, the first one by Elizabeth Gaskell, who was a friend of Charlotte's. And from that point on, even into the late 20th century, Charlotte really has dominated the picture. We know so much about her compared to Emily, and she has certainly controlled the narrative in a number of ways because she was the last surviving sister. So I really wanted to recapture Emily and recover Emily from the past.
Yeah, you take readers into the intimate, everyday details of life for the characters of Emily's Ghost. Now that we know that you were as a 4- and 5-year-old in this world, so to speak, I'm wondering now, though, as you sat down to think about writing a novel of Emily, forgive me, mm-hmm. how you began imagining the place, the time, and the circumstances of her life.
Well, first of all, I think there was a sort of a natural way to do that in that the place where I grew up, even though it's in West Virginia, not in Yorkshire in England, was very similar in terms of the landscape, very similar in the fact that, yes, it was an isolated place, and yet it was also a very industrialized place. In the case of Haworth, it was textile mills and coal mining to an extent, and, of course, coal mining in West Virginia where I grew up. So I felt like I was easily able to imagine myself back into the place. And then I do write historical fiction, and I'm very used to imagining myself back into earlier times as well. I tend, when I do that, to immerse myself in the time period, listen to the music of the time period, read the books of the time period, and so forth. And then just to try to explore the Brontes, especially through the primary sources we have, through letters and so forth. We don't have much from Emily, but we do have a lot from Charlotte, and you can sort of infer from what Charlotte says, you can sort of figure out Emily, too. So that's kind of the process that I tried to use.
How did you begin to conjure up the clergy daughter school?
Well, that, you know, that Charlotte did that very well in Jane Eyre. In fact, Lowood School in Jane Eyre is she based on the clergy daughter school and her experiences there. And, in fact, it was such a close portrayal, including the minister who was in charge, the Reverend William Caris Wilson, in the book in Jane Eyre, it's Mr. Brocklehurst, that William Caris Wilson and some of his friends threatened to sue or to at least take Charlotte to court to get the book squashed. And she defended it very strongly and said, yes, these things did happen, and I have school friends who can corroborate them, so nothing came of any kind of legal effort. But she apparently, and from what historical research has been done, she really did a good job of capturing the way that school was. So I really didn't have, I pretty much depended upon Charlotte's portrayal there.
Mm. One of the strengths of Emily's Ghost is the dialogue in these pages. How did you find the voices for these characters?
Well, I read their work over and over, I also read other works from the time period, which helped me sort of get back into that 19th century Victorian, early Victorian time period. I do that a lot with my work. I'm not sure exactly how, but I've written a book set in medieval England, and at that time I read a lot of Chaucer, I've written a book about Nazi Germany and read a lot of German literature in the 20th century. So you know, I always tend to try to channel those kinds of voices and stick as close as I can to the time period.
Yeah. In the book's prologue, we see Emily telling her father, Patrick, she's dying of consumption, and she wants her freedom not to be coddled in her illness.
Right.
How important was freedom and independence to Emily Brontë, and how important is it to her in Emily's Ghost?
I think it was very important. Charlotte Brontë has said that for Emily, freedom was most important of all. And she says that, I think, in the preface to Wuthering Heights. Emily writes about freedom in her poems. One of the poems that I use in the book itself is a poem about a hawk that she was trying to raise, an orphaned hawk that she kept in a cage and was trying to figure out how to free it. And she writes about freedom for the hawk and for herself. She compares herself to the hawk. So it was very important, and I did try to use that story, the poem and the hawk in the book, for example, to think about the place of women in that time period and the constraints that they had, to show Emily rebelling against that to an extent.
Yeah. There was one Brontë boy, and then also we should probably talk just a little bit more about Patrick, the father. He must have been quite an interesting man.
He was, and so was the son. In addition to trying to sort of rehabilitate Emily, also tried to rehabilitate Patrick, the father, and Branagh, the son, because they don't come off very well in Mrs. Gaskell's biography, the first biography. And I think there are probably a number of reasons for that. But problem with Branagh's portrayals is that people in the 19th century really didn't understand addiction. They didn't understand it as a disease as we do today, and so he was sort of seen as a moral failure because he was addicted to alcohol. He was an alcoholic, and he also became addicted to laudanum. And I can see a lot of good in him that got ignored in many of the early biographies because he was treated as this addict who was a sort of a moral reprobate sort of person. So I wanted to rehabilitate him. Also, Patrick comes across in Mrs. Gaskell's biography as very eccentric, and I found that modern historians have found that a lot of her stories about him just frankly weren't true. Apparently she was a bit taken aback by him and proceeded to write every bad thing she could think of. But in many cases, it turns out to be absolutely false. And he actually was a very interesting person, very involved in his community, very dedicated to this very poor textile mill town and the workers there.
Yeah. And that gets us to the other character central to your novel, William Waitman.
Right.
He's a man of great idealism. What would you like to tell us about him and the relationship between the two, Emily and William?
Well, he was very dedicated to the poor. The fact that he came to Haworth at all, he could have had a very comfortable church in a fairly well-to-do parish. He was from a well-to-do family. But he chose to come to this isolated place where the average life expectancy in Haworth was 27 years old. Terrible living conditions, terrible working conditions and so forth. So just to come there at all was an act of idealism, I think. But he also was a very attractive young man. You can see the portrait that Charlotte painted of him in some of the biographies. He apparently had a reputation as a flirt. The ladies loved him. All three of the Bronte girls were attracted to him. In Emily's case, he was the only male outside the family that she grew close to. And we have that from a number of sources, including some of Charlotte's friends and their letters. So about all we do have. I had to sort of then imagine myself into these characters and show what I've felt was an attraction, but that never is consummated. And in some ways, that makes it stronger, I think.
Yeah. Now, William Waitman, what kind of an impact did he have when he came to town, on the town?
Well, he had a great deal of impact. I think he was very much loved in the town. And I'll have to give away a bit of a plot point to say that Patrick survived him and so preached his funeral. And when he did, you can read the sermon, and Patrick makes the point a number of times how well-loved he was. Also, the town put up a plaque in his honor inside the church after he died, which that church doesn't have very many plaques. So this plaque sort of attesting how much people appreciated him can be seen in Haworth today.
Yeah. It's very interesting. This character, William Waitman, is an advocate for workers.
Mm-hmm.
And your family, according to an article I found online, was dependent on the prosperity of a coal mine there in West Virginia where you live. And you mentioned a little bit a few minutes ago in this interview that you'd grown up in West Virginia. How has your background influenced the stories you wish to tell in your fiction?
Well, I think it feels like the stories choose me, but they probably do it to an extent. But also, the reason they choose me is because of the interests that I do have. There are all sorts of novels I could write, but the ones that I tend to want to write are about people who are struggling against some sort of injustice, who stand up for what's right, in several cases of working class people who the progress that's been made in the last two centuries against great odds, unfortunately, to just have a living wage and decent working conditions. And in the case of England, just to have the right to vote, which was considered a radical thing back in the Bronte's day. So I'm drawn to those stories. I think those are still pertinent today as we struggle today to provide health care for everybody. There are still issues like that that need to be looked at. Mm.
What story is calling you now?
Well, the thing I'm thinking about next is about two kids growing up in the 1960s in West Virginia and dealing with the impingement of the Vietnam War.
Mm. Interesting. Well, I hope we'll talk again.
Thanks a lot.
Denise Giardina. Her most recent novel is Emily's Ghost, a novel of the Bronte sisters. The book is published by Norton.
Earth and sky.
All countries will have to join up and work together to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
You're listening to Lawrence Lawrenson. He's an economist with the OECD, which is 30 countries, including the U.S., whose stated goal is to promote economic stability and democracy among both rich and poor nations. Lawrenson spoke about climate change.
The important and very difficult issue to deal with is who is going to take action, where is this action going to take place, and who is going to pay for it.
Lawrenson looks to the U.S. for leadership on climate issues.
There's no doubt that that the U.S. could do more to reduce its own greenhouse gases by increasing the prices of fossil fuels, either by using taxes or trading systems.
Money for a tax on carbon, or a cap-and-trade system, he said, could be used to invest in renewable energy technologies, not only for the U.S., but also for India and China.
The point here is that many of the cheapest options to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are in China and India. But you couldn't expect them to do that unless it is paid by the richer countries, at least in part.
Lawrenson spoke at the March 2009 America's Climate Choices Summit in Washington, D.C. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. At the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319.
Coming up next on The World from PRI, Israel's settlements in the West Bank have been called a stumbling block to Middle East peace. An Israeli diplomat in the U.S. criticized the settlement policy in a memo to his boss. When it was leaked, it inspired a media firestorm in Israel. Meet the memo's author, Israel's consul general to New England. Today on The World, that story and the day's news coming up on the program from PRI. It's 2 minutes before 3 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3.